The question, again, the question is not how fast can I take notes? In fact, that wasn't even funny. That was a real question. The question is this, like, remember, you're listening, being here, we're listening to Holst in order for us to go home and write like Holst, right? We're listening to music, but not because the listening to the music is what life is about. It's about writing music when we leave here. It's hard work. But I want to tell you, there is no work that is any more glorious in all the world than learning to live like God and how God has called us to live with one another. So what does it mean for us then to live this integrated whole life? What does it mean for us to do that? What does this word integration mean as we start to see it in different domains of how the mind operates? That's what we're going to do for the rest of our time in this next hour before we go to Q&A. If you want to come and hear a professional choir sing Handel's Messiah, you want to come and get your money's worth, right? Which means you don't want a choir in which all 100 voices sing the same notes. You want people who are singing bass and alto and tenor and soprano and first soprano and first tenor and so forth and so on, right? So you want them to be each well differentiated. You want each of those sections to know their part really well and to sing their part really well, and each of those parts is going to be different than other parts in the choir. But you also don't want a choir in which those people who can sing really well just deciding they're going to sing whatever they please and however and whenever they please. I don't just want good sopranos and good tenors. I actually want them paying attention to each other because I want to get my money's worth. This is what we mean anytime we talk about a system that is integrated. Integrated systems are systems that are well differentiated. We have differentiated parts. Those sopranos and tenors and basses and altos know their parts really well because they've each explicitly gotten good exercise doing what they are supposed to do. But we also know that in order for them to function well, they have to be linked. An integrated system is one in which the subset parts are well differentiated and linked together. That's why we have a conductor for the choir. That's why your brain has a prefrontal cortex. That's why the body of Jesus has Jesus. That's why that's the role of the Holy Spirit. I have a spiritual director that I see. I've been seeing him for well over 20 years now. He's been in the U.S. for a long time, but he's originally from New Zealand. I tell people I just go to listen to the guy talk. A number of years ago, he said to me, "Remember, Kurt, there's not a single relationship on the planet that is not mediated by Jesus. The question is whether or not we're paying attention to it." Which, of course, is kind of challenging when I'm in the middle of a fight with my wife. Because I'm wondering, like, well, where is Jesus now? Because if he were here, he would certainly be siding with moi. It is a question, though, right? Are we paying attention to the conductor? But what if we grew up in a house, not unlike our friend Steve, where certain parts of my mind's activity simply didn't get any practice? You see, because as we said, our minds are both embodied and relational, and because they're relational, and because we are storytellers, as we will see this afternoon, because we're storytellers, we are constantly telling stories about who we are. And you see, for Steve, His story was such that when he was growing up as a kid, he was all about science. All about science. But his parents, God-fearing people that they were afraid of science. Because Steve was going off to school and they were teaching things like evolution and so forth and so on. And regardless of what you think about this, the bottom line was it made his parents nervous. Right? It's funny how that four-syllable word, evolution, can make so many people so nervous. It's amazing. It's like it's worse than a grenade. You throw a grenade in a room, people, I don't know what that is. Evolution, we're running for the doors. Right? It's hard. It's difficult. Right? But the point was that their response to it was to discourage him from science because they were worried. Remember, these were not bad people. They're lovely people. They were afraid. And so when Steve left home for college, he left faith behind. Because why would anyone in good conscience stick around with something in which the thing that you dream about, the thing that you long for, the thing that you most love was actively discouraged? And so you see, there were certain elements of Steve's life, his interest, his longings, what he felt, what he desired, that simply never got any practice at home. And what happens in the brain when certain things don't get practiced? In the brain, we like to say that what you don't use, you lose. This is also one of the rules of neuroplasticity. If I don't use it, I lose it. If I'm not having people come to find me, if I'm not having people come to give me the experience of being known, and not just what were the facts of my day, but what were the feelings of my day, what were the relationships like of my day, if I'm not having people come to ask those questions of me, those parts of my brain literally do not turn on. Steve was practicing in his house not turning on emotional states. He was practicing not doing something. And by the time his son was too depressed to do anything but hang himself, Steve didn't understand why it was that all of his brightness and all of his science couldn't have stopped that train. When the truth was that Steve didn't have much practice himself knowing how to have a conversation with his son about what his son felt, because Steve himself didn't know what Steve felt. Does that make sense? Evil loves this. That would be an example of a disintegrated system for Steve, also for his son, but also in Steve's family growing up. And we all in this room have parts of us that feel pretty disintegrated. Now, we might not feel disintegrated on the whole. I mean, like, look at you. Like, you're pretty, like, you're upright and you have a pulse. You're all looking pretty good here this morning, right? And because we're all pretty good at, just like Steve was, we're all really good at using the strengths that are at our disposal to do the things that we have to do in life to get by. And like, most people are not going to look at us and say, like, my goodness, like, you look awful. Well, we hope they don't, right? Because we're working so hard to make sure that we don't look awful. Because I'm compensating for the parts of me that feel God-awful. But I've been practicing it for so long, just like Steve, I didn't even know it. The 86th Psalm, the 11th verse, says this: create in me, O Lord, an undivided heart. But before it says that, it says, teach me your way that I may walk in your truth. Create in me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. Teach me your way. Notice, teach your way. Teaching is not, to be on the way is movement, right? The mind is moving, right? It's not a logical, linear set of facts. It's not a theology. Theology is an important, really important part of our life. But life does not begin with theology. Theology is the way that we make sense of a life that we are already living. Teach me your way that I may walk in your truth, that I may walk truly. Truth there is not referred to as some abstraction. It is about living true relationship, that I may walk in your true relationship with you and with others. Create in me an undivided heart. Here's the thing. We have minds that are divided. And by divided, as we're going to talk about in just a moment, we have multiple different domains of the mind. And the writer is asking for help. Our minds will not be undivided on our own. We can't do this by ourselves. It's not possible. Neurobiologically, it is not possible. It's like pushing against the earth. You can't do it. Well, maybe you can here in Texas, because there's lots of things you can do here that you can't do anywhere else in the world, I'm told. And so what does it mean then for us to live in these states of integration? One thing to bear in mind again, right? Two neurons come together. And if you know much about neurons these days, and neurons are like in the news a lot, right? Because the brain's a very sexy organ. It's very sexy, right? If you want to sell more yogurt, put a picture of the brain on your advertisement. You'll sell more yogurt automatically, right? And so we have these things called neurons, these brain cells, these neurons, and they come together, and when they talk to each other, they don't touch exactly, right? There's a thing in between, there's a space in between. We call it a what? A synapse, right? Oh, you're a very well-educated group here. Great. So synapse, this space in between. Neurons don't actively ever talk to each other directly. They talk to each other indirectly. There's always a space in between. And I want to suggest to us, that space is where the Holy Spirit works, right? There's always this space in between. No human interaction ever takes place that is not mediated by Jesus, that is not mediated by the triune God. The question is whether or not we're paying attention to it. And the next time that you're about to have a fight with your kid, if we pause and say, wait, I first need to make sure that I'm paying attention to Jesus being in the middle of this conversation, how will that change what I say? And so we enter into these different domains of integration. The first one that we like to talk about is the domain of consciousness. Consciousness. Are you conscious? You're like, I'm not really sure. I know the person sitting next to me is not. He is asleep. Right? You wait till this afternoon, right? Right? When the death knell comes, right? That bewitching hour right after lunch. Believe you me, I'm going to have some fun with a microphone up here. Because I'm going to look out, I'm going to see somebody. Wait till somebody starts to snore at your table. Oh, it's happening. I'll tell you. It's happened to me before. You're like, oh my gosh. Like, shame is just going to be everywhere in the room. The domain of consciousness. It's important to know. Before we do anything else in the world, we actually have to be awake. We have to be conscious. Are you awake? Are you alert? And are you attuned? Those three A's. Are you awake? Are you alert? And are you attuned? Am I attuned not just, first of all, to myself? Am I attuned to others in the room? Here's something that's important to know. Your brain already is very attuned to the people around you, whether you know it or not. Your brain's paying a lot of attention to everybody else in the room. The question is whether at the level of the prefrontal cortex, at the level of the part of me that is actually aware that I'm aware of things, am I paying attention at that level to things? Here's a question. How well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to? Attention is the primary function of the domain of consciousness. Attention is like the ignition key in the mind. Nothing that we do we without a shift in our attention. We're shifting our attention all the time. Sometimes we're paying attention to things that are outside of our skin, like some speaker on a stage. Sometimes we're paying attention to things that are on the inside of our skin. I'm having a thought about, like, where are we gonna go for lunch? Where are we gonna go for lunch? We just, we keep thinking, right? Or like, oh my gosh, I have laundry that is in the washer that I didn't take out, right? Our minds are going all kinds of places. And most of the time, that movement of our attention is done quite on autopilot. Most of us are not directing our attention. Our attention is directing us. How well are we paying attention to what we pay attention to? The fifth verse of the eighth chapter of Romans, Paul writes, "The mind that is on the spirit is life, and the mind that is on the flesh is death." Our minds are either on the spirit or on the flesh. And by on the spirit, we mean the things of God. We don't mean like the ethereal as opposed to the material. Right, the flesh there that Paul's referring to, he's not referring to the flesh like my flesh, like the floor, material, the chairs, the tables, human beings, buildings. That's not the flesh. The flesh there is the things of the kingdom of darkness. When he writes again in Colossians chapter 3, "Therefore, focus your attention on things above." He's not talking about like at like 30,000 feet, right? He's not talking about Jupiter, which is like way above. No, he's talking about the things of God. Focus our how well are we paying attention to the things that we're paying attention to? I want to just suggest to you, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to pay attention to what we're paying attention to. And that's where we begin. Then we talk about the next domain, that being the vertical domain. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? This is 1 Corinthians 6:19. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? For you've been bought with a price. Notice Paul doesn't here say, do you not know that your mind is the temple of the Holy Spirit? That your brain is the temple of the Holy Spirit? That your soul, that your spirit? Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? Now here's, for those of you like biblical scholars, you know, like Paul does this strange thing all the time in the New Testament. He intermixes his pronouns. You know this? So in one sentence, he'll say the word your, that will be singular, and like five words later, it'll be your, that'll be plural. But in English, it's your and your. Here's something to know. When he says this, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? You know, we read that. And like as individuals, I'm reading the Bible, and I think that Paul's talking to me, to Kurt. He's talking to us. So he's not just referring to my body alone. He is referring to that. Do you not know that your body, your physical, remember, the mind is an embodied and relational process. But it's also not just my body, it is our body. Our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Ask this question. How often is the Holy Spirit trying to send you messages through your body and you're just not paying attention? How much of the Holy Spirit's work do we miss because I don't pay attention to what my heart rate is telling me, to what my GI tract is telling me, to what the tension in my musculature is telling me? I'm just not paying attention because I'm not really able to take that seriously, what Paul says. It's a nice metaphor. It's nice theology for whatever it means, but it certainly doesn't mean that I need to pay attention to my actual physicality. Not unless we want to love the Lord our God with all of our mind. How well are we paying attention to what we're paying attention to, including this particular domain of the mind? We next come to the horizontal domain. Now, as far as the brain is concerned, by this vertical domain, again, because when we're standing, we think about this verticality. I don't even think that's a word, verticality. We'll use it, right? We'll go with it. And now we're going to move on to the horizontally. We have a right and we have a left brain. You may not know that, but you do. And they function very differently. The right brain has certain features that tend to come online, and they come online before those in the left brain do, right? So when you're born, your right brain is in charge of most of your life's activity for about the first 18 to 24 months of life. And your left brain takes a while to come online. Your right brain is in charge of things like learning visual spatial orientation, where I am in the universe, an internal holistic map of the body. So not just my sense of where my body is on the stage, but my sense of what I sense internally in my body all runs to the right hemisphere. Nonverbal cues. 60 to 80% of all human communication is nonverbal. Body language, facial expression, eye contact, tone of voice, timing and intensity of response, gestures. Those seven different nonverbal cues communicate so much more than we are aware of. And I don't just communicate those things to other people. I communicate those very things to myself. Right? If I cross my arms when I'm at a party because I'm nervous, because nobody knows me, I'm not just telling you, stay away. I'm also telling me, this is not a safe place for me to be. Right? I send myself messages in the same way that I send other people messages. That's all in the right hemisphere. So much of who we are emerges out of that. We like to say that the brain typically, overly generalized, but it's true, it operates bottom to top and right to left. Bottom to top and right to left. Up the spinal cord, brainstem, up into the right hemisphere. And it sends then to the left hemisphere, where the left hemisphere is constantly trying to make sense of what the right hemisphere is sending it. My logical, linear, linguistic, literal brain. Have you read the Psalms recently? I don't know how many of us are like currently like living and breathing in the Psalms. The Psalms are an amazing place where our horizontal domain is integrated, right? Because you have all kinds of words that the left brain loves, but they're written how? In poetry. And they're put to music. And so I can't just read linearly. If I'm going to take this seriously, if I live in the Psalms, I'm actively integrating my right hemisphere. Especially, right, when I get to things like Psalm 137. You read Psalm 137 recently? You know that one, right? The whole thing where the psalmist is having great pleasure at the babies of Babylon being dashed upon the rocks. Like, that's just not very politically correct. I don't know if they knew that or not. It's not a cool thing to write. Like, I'm really digging, like, killing babies. Right? We would, we would never write that today. But here's the thing. It is a part of the biblical narrative in which the writers are writing what they write because they assume that they serve a God who can take it. There's not a thing that we read in the Psalms that is not something we experience in the human life. Our human condition is completely captured there. But remember, the psalmist in 86 asks for outside help. This integration process, my consciousness, my vertical brain, my horizontal brain, these things are not going to happen by myself. I need someone outside of me coming to help me do this, coming to find me. Evil is counting on this not happening. And this is where shame most effectively works, isolating us such that these states of integration don't happen. I don't really have time to read the Psalms right now. How many of you checked your phones at the break? Did I actually give you permission to look at your phones during the break? Now, this is what happens, right? Psychiatrists have this uncanny way of helping people feel really bad so they have to keep coming back to see them. It's part of our training. Evil does not want this integrated process to work, and it uses shame as a way to make sure it's not happening. That's our horizontal mind. Memory. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, on four occasions, Moses, speaking for God, says to the children of Israel, "Do not forget the Lord your God. Remember the Lord your God," four times in that chapter. "Because on the day that you forget, in that day when you enter the land of Canaan and your houses are big and your highways are broad and you forget your God, calamity will come upon you." Remember, 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 remember. One thing I'd like to say about memory is that its primary purpose, as it turns out, is not so much about the past. We remember for the purpose of anticipating our future, which is why we say that we're constantly remembering our future. Yes, I remember what I had for breakfast. I remember where I put my keys. But most of why I want to remember something is so that I know what to do in the future. What we pay attention to, we remember. And what we remember becomes our anticipated future. That's the way the brain works. What we pay attention to, we remember. But what if I'm Steve? And I'm living in a house where nobody's really inviting me to pay attention to things that I feel, to things that I desire. What if I'm, look, if you're a female in this, like for all the women who are in this room right now, anywhere from 3 to 4 out of 10, by the time of 25, have been sexually actively mistreated. Gentlemen, look around. And who's talking about that? Who wants to remember that? The problem is, there are certain ways in which our brain remembers that don't require me paying attention. There's a form of memory called implicit memory. Many of us might be familiar. If you're familiar with these things, you'll know about this. Implicit memory is active at birth. It requires parts of the brain that do not include the prefrontal cortex. So I don't even have to be thinking about it that I'm having to remember. I do. So it's the kind of thing that I remember, like I remember learning how to walk. I remember learning how to eat. I remember learning how to ride a bicycle. My body just remembers how to do this. But it's not just physical things that I remember. What about the couple that comes home at the end of the day and they have a fight? And in the middle of the fight, he just leaves the house, gets in his car and takes off. This happened. And later you're asking him like, dude, like, what are you thinking? Like, that's a helpful tactic for marriage work? No. He's likely to say, as he did, I didn't want to say something that I would regret. And I also know how she gets when she gets really mad. He did not say, I think I was having an implicit memory of what it was like when I was 10 and my raging alcoholic father would come home and the only way I knew how to handle it was to get on my bike and take off. He thinks he's just having a fight with his wife. He thinks that he's just simply trying to regulate that moment when he gets in his car. No, he's regulating 35 years worth of life. And how many of us, day in and day out, moment by moment, find ourselves in the present moment thinking that we're just regulating here and now, when I'm regulating 5 decades worth of life? That's a lot to regulate. Eventually, around 18 to 24 months of age, your left brain starts to come online. Your prefrontal cortex starts to develop. Your hippocampus starts to come online. It helps you remember things short term. And you begin to remember things explicitly. We call this explicit memory or semantic memory. My capacity to remember facts and my capacity to remember time travel, meaning I have a sense of moving through time. I remember that having breakfast this morning feels closer than having breakfast last week. I remember vacation last summer. I remember the conversation that we had last night in the kitchen when you said, oh, yes, you did. Don't tell me you didn't say that. But isn't it interesting? Right? We like to think of memory as being this thing that's in a safety deposit box. Right? This thing that happened, I remember it, and I just put it in the box, and I put it in the bank, and when I want to go get it, I get it out, and there it is. But you know, as far as the brain is concerned, as we like to say, there's actually no such thing as the past or the future, as far as the brain is concerned. By this, we don't mean that there's no such thing as history. We don't mean that things didn't happen. Yes, things happen. But our memory of things happened is something that's taking place in my brain right now. And we know that memory shifts and is malleable over time. We know that I can recall events differently depending upon the context in which I'm actually recalling them. than the way they actually were. Memory is, as it turns out, is quite fluid, which is why the fish that I caught that was really this long is now this long. Because if I tell a story frequently enough in which the fish is this long, this is how I practice remembering the fish's length. Are you with me? And by the time I've told this story 100 times, I believe it. It is what really happened to me. It doesn't matter what the pictures show. The pictures are wrong. They're fake pictures. Oh, come on, that was a joke. Yeah, fake news. Come on, like, you guys, yeah, okay. Moving on. Memory's a tricky thing. What does Jesus mean when he says, whenever you do this in remembrance of me? What are we remembering? To remember me. What is the me? Who is the me? Who is the Jesus that I'm remembering? Am I just remembering some passage out of some old ancient scriptural text? Or am I picturing, sensing, imaging Jesus in all of his fullness? Am I remembering Jesus remembering me? Am I remembering Jesus looking at me at the table? Like, how well am I paying attention even to what I am remembering? Part of our problem for many of us is that our implicit and our explicit narratives have had a very difficult time being brought together in an appropriate fashion. And so for our friend who jumps in his car and takes off in the middle of his argument with his wife, doesn't have any idea that he's really fleeing his dad. Steve, in his grief, does not have any idea that his grief is not just about the loss of his boy. It is about 50 years of loss of his relationship with his parents. Because he doesn't remember, because it was never brought to his attention that this is something that he might forget in the first place. How many of us in this room, even now, like our stories are coming up and I'm finding my story in these examples. I'm finding the places where my implicit memory is like running me over like a truck. And I don't know how to get it stopped. How well are we paying attention to what we remember? Narrative. We're going to wade into this in even more detail this afternoon when we talk about storytelling. But as far as the brain is concerned, one of the things that we do, again, like we said, that we do that we don't think that any other animal does, is that we eventually come to tell stories. We tell stories about our lives, and in fact, we do so commonly that we can't not do this. And we don't have to use words all the time. We can use impressions, we can use senses, a whole range of different ways in which we are telling stories. We are narrating our life. The brain operates bottom to top and right to left. And the left brain is constantly in the business of narrating what the rest of the body and the mind is sending to it. What if my narrator doesn't have different story pieces in order to include in the story it wants to tell? Narration for us falls into the category of attachment research. Some of you here might be familiar with attachment research. And one of the things that we know about attachment research, this notion that infants, newborns, from the time they are born, are seeking to find someone seeking them in order for them to make sense of their own life. We like to say that every newborn comes into the world looking for someone looking for her. Looking for someone, looking for him, and it never stops. And part of what I'm looking for is someone to help me tell my story. I don't know this as a newborn. You know, you wonder things about newborns. All the interviews that have been lost that they wouldn't tell us, right? That they wouldn't give to us, right? Any women here ever give birth to a baby? Right. And was labor like a walk in the park? No. Like labor is like they call it labor for a reason, right? It's difficult. It's painful, right? At least I'm told, right? But what if you're the kid? I mean, my goodness. Think if you're the fetus. You come through a tube that's this big, and you weigh 9 pounds, and you get through like nobody is there interviewing the child. Say, son, how was the trip? And he's like, in a minute, I'm trying to catch my breath. They're spanking my butt. I don't know. Can you imagine, as an adult, if you were put into a situation in which someone was going to squeeze you through a tube that's about this big around? It is a traumatic event. Like if I'm coming through the birth canal and I get like, you better believe I'm looking for somebody looking for me. I was quite fine about 4 hours ago. And attachment is hugely important because it is the process whereby which the immature infant brain utilizes and accesses the hopefully mature adult brain to help organize itself. That's what attachment is. The immature infant brain accesses and utilizes the mature adult brain in order to help organize itself. And this process never stops. We are constantly looking to the other, in our lives in order for us to help organize ourselves. Always. We look to it in friends. We look to it in spouses. We look to it in pastors. We look to it in children. We look to it in parents. We look to it in employers. We look to it in employees. We look to it a range of different ways. Every conceivable intimate human interaction is an attachment crisis waiting to happen. Conflict under any human circumstances is a conflict of attachment. It's a crisis of attachment. My sense that you are leaving me. Why does God say in Genesis 2:18, it is not good for the man to be alone? Why doesn't God just say, hey, I think I'll make another? Why is there any commentary? And I want to suggest this anthropological commentary is huge. It's not good for man to be alone. And we know it. We sense it. We feel it. The problem is that if we're going to be with somebody, we have to be with other people. This is a problem. Because the people all remind me of my mother and my father. Or my older sister or brother. Who are behaving like a second or third parent. And we have different forms of attachment. We talk about securely attached people. People who connected well with their parents. Their parents were attuned and paying attention to them. And then we have these other forms of attachment that are relatively insecure. We could spend a whole weekend just talking about attachment. But what about attachment plays a role for us? So here's an example. So a guy comes to me, he's about 38 years old, and he is a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon. I'm like, if you've got that many syllables in your title, you've got to be smart. He's a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon. And he's got a pedigree from here to the moon. All the right schools. Really smart, you know, active in his church. But the reason he's in my office is because his wife wanted him to come. It's always the case, right? They have a 2-year-old son, and the 2-year-old son is rather precocious. And this guy says, I'm here because my wife, I'm here because I want to have another child. And my wife says, we can't have another child until I get things figured out. I'm like, well, okay, well, what is it to figure out? He says, like, I don't know. I think my wife should come. I'm like, yep, isn't that the way it always is? Yep. But, so I said, well, wait, let's just tell me why, what's going on in your life? Well, okay, she was complaining about the way he was treating their two-year-old son because of his impatience. And the comment being like, look, you're a rising star in the field that you're in. You're a pediatrician, for crying out loud, and you're having trouble with our two-year-old son. I don't want another kid coming into the world under these circumstances. So he's like, okay, I'll go. And as part of a standard psychiatric evaluation, we do lots of questions. We ask lots of questions. And this guy has a clean bill of health from a mental health standpoint. No history of depression, no history of anxiety, no history of abuse, no history of substance misuse, nothing. But there were two things in our evaluation that were striking to me. One was that for a guy who's this bright, he had a rather limited vocabulary when it came to talking about feelings. Right? Really smart. But when it came to talking about feelings, his vocabulary was rather limited. Things were good, things were nice, things were fine. Not very nuanced. And the other thing that was striking was for a guy who's this smart, he didn't have many explicit memories of his life before he was about 12 years of age. Pretty uncommon for a person who's been this successful. And so we did this little thing called a body scan. It doesn't involve any technology. You just simply have someone relax and close their eyes, take a couple deep breaths where they're sitting. And then we systematically ask them to begin to visualize and imagine their body, paying attention, start with their feet, work their way through their legs, their torso. We get to his stomach. We're just doing this. And he says, I'm remembering something. I'm having a feeling. It's a felt memory first, right? His body remembers something, and an image comes to his mind, and he remembers being about, suddenly he goes on to, I'm about 10 years old, and he's standing in his driveway, watching his mother and his two-year-old brother standing at the edge of the sidewalk, just as and before his brother bolts into the street and is hit and killed by a car. Now, here's the strange thing. I'd already asked the question, have you had any major traumatic losses? No. How many siblings do you have? I have two. He'd had three. Really, really, really smart guy. But isn't it striking how much trouble he's now having emotionally as his son becomes 2 years of age? Now, we came to find out that this is a guy who'd grown up in a family in which his parents, who loved him and loved his brothers, didn't talk about this with him, didn't process this with him. But his mind will not forget, and it comes to find him, as God will. This is not unlike the God of Genesis chapter 3 when he knows. When he knows that his kids are in trouble, he comes to find. What parts of us are in trouble that desperately, desperately need someone to come and find them? Because we've all got them. Our attachment processes end up, as it turns out, become neurally ingrained. What happens between me and my parents becomes embedded in my brain. Secure attachment is highly correlated with active function of the 9 different features of the middle prefrontal cortex. What does that all mean? It means that when I have secure attachment, the things that the most important part of my brain learns how to do it really, really well. And when a secure attachment doesn't happen, they don't learn how to do things very well. What does it mean for us to be integrated in our narratives? The next domain that we talk about is the domain of state. I like to tell people that, when I'm at the office, We have a small private practice in Virginia. And when I'm at the office where I own and run the practice, like, I am master of the universe. And at the end of the day, I leave the office and I go home where I am not master of the universe. The problem is I often don't remember that that's the case. If you get up on your average Saturday morning and you have work that you have to do, whatever those work clothes are, whatever that job is you're going to do, you wake up and you automatically begin to do things, right? You go get on your clothes, you go get your breakfast, you go do things, and then you're going to go do your work. But if you were going to get up on that Saturday morning and you were going to go play tennis, your brain would be set into a very, very different state that is neurally based. You activate a neural model of this is what we do when we go play tennis. And you're just automatically on that train and you go. Or you're automatically on the train of this is what we do when we get up to go to work in the morning. So much of like what I'm doing is the same thing that happens when you get in your car, turn the ignition on, buckle your seatbelt, and then you start to drive places while you're doing all kinds of other stuff in your head. But you're in the state of mind that allows you to drive your car and not think about it. We do multiple things without thinking about them because we have literally entered particular states of mind. Most of the trouble of humanity happens in the transition from one state to another because we're not paying attention. And of course, we can have larger states that have sub-states. I can be at work, which is different than being at home, but even at work, I have different things that I do throughout the day. And so when I'm in a state where I'm seeing one particular person, I have a different state if I'm seeing a different particular person, or a different state if we enter into a staff meeting. Right? We have all these different things. The reason that phone's still going is because that person has sworn not to pick it up because I told him not to. These different states that we enter into, again, are a function of to what degree am I paying attention to what I'm paying attention to. Evil would have it be such that, first of all, I'm just not very aware of whatever states I've happened to enter into. I'm not aware of them, number one. Number two, it would have me be unaware of the fact that I'm moving from one state to another, to another, to another. And it is in those transitions that I simply begin to do things quite automatically that lead to all kinds of disintegration in my relationships and within myself. It's in that space also where shame neurobiologically works, and we'll talk more about that as we move forward. You know, we said that in the sixth chapter of John, Jesus feeds the 5,000. And you get to the end of that story, and it says, and he went away, right, because they were going to what? Make him king by force. We're seeing that Jesus is very well aware of the state that he's in and is going to have to transition somewhere else because of the high degree of acuity that he's paying to this particular state of mind. Then we get to this next domain of the mind, the domain of the interpersonal. In John 5, Jesus is really making everybody around him uncomfortable because he's saying things like, I and the Father are one. I and the Father are one. Jesus has a deep awareness that he's deeply connected to another. That the domain, like my mind is deeply dependent upon, my mind's domain of interpersonality. It means that like anytime I enter a room, I'm connected to whoever else is in the room. The question is whether or not I'm paying attention to this. Furthermore, how many of us, when we walk into the room, become self-conscious? Like all day, every day for me, right? I'm Mr. Self-Conscious. But what would it be like for us to walk into the room already being deeply aware of how connected we already are to everybody else who's in the room. Well, that's hard for me to do, because in order for me to do that, I'd have to be well aware of all these other domains that have preceded this one. I would have to be doing the work of being deeply aware that Jesus is mediating every single relationship that's going on in the room. I would have to be deep, and by aware of, I don't mean like I happen to know that as an abstract fact that I learned once at some like seminar on shame. No, I'm practicing, paying attention to this, and in so doing, I am neuroplastically changing what my brain is doing so that after 6 months of this, this becomes the automatic practice of state of mind that I enter into. That I recognize the truth that I am eternally, interpersonally bound. It is not good for man to be alone. Let us make mankind in our image. And you're thinking, gosh, like, I'm just not sure this is such a good idea. Like, I'm doing all this work. She's not doing that much work. He's not doing that much work. It's not working for me. Yeah, I mean, I think to myself, heaven, like the whole interpersonal domain, there are other people that are doing this work. Like, there are going to be people in heaven, and I'm going to be upset about it. I mean, you know this. We all know this. We all have people in our lives that we've had unfinished business with that, like, for some reason, like, they're going to get in. And we think they shouldn't be getting in. And it's going to be distressing when we get there. And Jesus says, hey, Kurt. Yep. Sean, he's over here. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, I thought heaven was like a really big place. Like, really big. And Jesus said, yeah, but we got like lots of time, right? I'm like, dang. So just to let you know. Like, we think, like, those relationships with people of faith that are fractured, we just figure, like, look, I'm just, like, not going to go confront that. I'm not going to go deal with that. I'll just, like, we'll just all get to heaven, and everything will be groovy. And I'm thinking, we're going to get to heaven, and it's not going to be nearly as groovy as I think it will be when Jesus says, like, look, if you want to be in my heaven, like, I'm willing to let anybody, as Dallas Willard said once, I'm willing to let anybody come into my heaven who can take it. That means that you, Kurt, have some unfinished business to do with Sean. But fortunately, we've got all day, all night, all forever. And I'm going to sit with you until we get this work done. And you're like, you want to cuss, but you can't because you're in heaven. This interpersonal domain of integration is hugely important, because when God, like, when God saved Abraham to save the world, right? He's saving a people. And we happen to be part of it. He's not saving us primarily as individuals. He's saving us as a people. And we happen to be part of this group that he's saving. And our brains, our minds, our interpersonal domains of integration bear testimony to this. That we don't do well apart from the work that we are doing along these integration lines with other people. And of course, this is another place where evil counts on shame doing its work to keep us separate from one another. We're almost there. The temporal domain. Now, this is another interesting thing, right? It's not often, I think, that you probably are having common conversation at Starbucks around the word eschatology. When's the last time you had a conversation with your friends about eschatology? You're playing poker. Hey, George, what's your eschatology these days? Our sense of the end times. Here's the thing. We all have one. Each one of us has an eschatology. Each one of us has a sense of how things are going to go down when it all goes down. We may not be paying attention to it. like me, given my profession as a sinner, how many of us, like myself, when I get really, really anxious about things, I'm not thinking about the new heaven and the new earth. I'm not thinking that it's coming. I'm not thinking that I have hope in Jesus. No. I'm worried that Duke might win another basketball game. That's not coming in the new heaven and new earth, is it? Here's the thing. One of the interesting things about people in time, what our minds do, we anticipate a future in which, in ways that other animals don't, right? I might, animals may remember where they put things in order to get them. But animals aren't thinking about their vacation next summer, right? Maybe in C.S. Lewis's Narnia series they were, but other than that, I don't think animals are thinking that much about their future in the same way. We think about our futures, and our futures are always coming back around to affect our present moment. What we pay attention to, we remember, and what we remember becomes our eschatology. We read in Revelation 21 about a new heaven and new earth. The question is whether or not we're allowing that eschatology to penetrate our present moment. And most of the time, if my narrative and my memory is disintegrated, Revelation 21 will have a hard time saying much to me. And evil is making sure that shame is an important way that we keep from believing that Revelation 21 is on the way. The last domain that we talk about is this made-up word, transpirational domain. And my friend Dan Siegel made up this word, and he said, to be transpirational, to live transpirationally, is to live in such a way that one is paying attention simultaneously to all of the eight domains that you just heard about. How hard does that feel to do that kind of work? I want to suggest to us that that is what it means to develop the mind of Christ. That the mind of Christ is to have the mind of Jesus, is to have the mind of one who is paying this attention to this depth of being, because in so doing, he's paying attention to his Father. What does he say? He says in John 5, I only do that which I see my Father doing. I only do that which I see my Father doing, which means he's paying a lot of attention to what his Father is doing. And the only way we're going to do this is if we're paying a lot of attention to how God speaks to us. And if our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, I'm going to have to be paying a lot of attention to what my body is saying, my body and my embodied interpersonal domain with you in community. Evil does not want this happening. The third verse of the fifth chapter of Romans says this: we glory not only in this hope, we glory also in our suffering, because suffering produces perseverance. We're going to come back to this verse tomorrow, but I want to say this. A lot of life is about perseverance. A lot of life is about practicing. Practicing, 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 practicing over and over and over again. From a neuroplastic standpoint, if you want to learn to play the piano, it's far better for you to practice for only 15 minutes a day, 6 days a week, than to practice for 90 minutes once a week. You're far more likely to enhance neuroplastic change. Perseverance is what life is largely about. But here's the thing. Because we live in the Amazon and McDonald's world, I don't want to have to persevere. I don't want to have to delay gratification. I don't want to have to wait for longer than 48 hours to get my Amazon Prime delivered. No. I don't want to wait this long for my marriage to heal. I don't want to wait this long for my child's addiction to be restored. I don't want to wait this long to be single. I don't want to wait this long to know if I'm going to be healed from this cancer. But there's something that's more important than this that's even at stake. And that is, I don't want to wait this long to become a Christian. You know, Kierkegaard? Did that name ring a bell? Kierkegaard. Yeah, you know, like really wicked smart dude. When I was in college, I loved dropping his name. I never read a thing he wrote. But I'm like, oh yeah, Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard. Right. Oh yeah. Have you read? You're like, I've read excerpts, right? But you never like read Kierkegaard, because to read Kierkegaard, you'd have to have like your left brain would have to be like the size of Montana. Like it would just be huge if you read Kierkegaard. If his name had been Smith, I'd never mentioned him because that's not a very sexy name. But Kierkegaard. Oh yeah. Oh, the Danish dude. Oh yeah, the philosophy. Yeah. But I'm reading him now. And one of the things that Kierkegaard is known for saying is that he was trying to become a Christian. Now, he's not trying to be theologically obtuse, or he's not trying to make waves. He's simply saying that life and following Jesus is about practicing what we want to become. And to become who we will be in the new heaven and new earth is something that we are constantly practicing. I'm trying to become a Christian. But you see, the brain has a really hard time. The brain has a really hard time without having temporal benchmarks. It likes to know, like if you were told that you had a chronic pain situation, you're like, ma'am, I'm sorry, I know that you've got a really bad back problem here. It's gonna be 6 weeks before it's fixed. You're like, 6 weeks, okay, I can deal with that. But if they were to say to you, if the doctors were to say to you, ma'am, it's clear you've got a bad back problem, you're gonna be this way for the rest of your life. We don't like that either. That would be even worse, right? Here's what's interesting. What's even worse is if they were to say, we see that you have a bad back problem, we don't know how long it's gonna take. Even if I know for a fact that it's gonna last the rest of my life, I am far more capable of tolerating that than I am tolerating not knowing how long something's gonna last. Perseverance is about practicing over and over and over and over again, even in the face of not knowing for certain what the end is going to be. We live with hope, not with certainty. But here's the thing. My brain loves to persevere when I'm doing it with somebody else. It's true. Even if we're going to keep doing this, remember, Jesus is here to say, this is really hard. Following me is hard to do, right? Jesus did not say, I love you and have a wonderful plan for your life. He did not say that. It's on the Bible. You won't find it anywhere. This is N.T. Wright's work. He's great. He said, Jesus said, I love you and I have a cross for you to bear. Like, dang. I thought that four spiritual laws thing was gonna work for me, right? I love you and I have a wonderful plan for your life. And here's the thing. When we are doing it with each other, joy abounds. But it does not, largely because of the work that shame has already wrought in our lives and we don't even know it. But good news is coming. You've already worked very hard. We're gonna now take 10, 15 minutes for Q&A and get you off to lunch. So there are two microphones. There's one here and one here. And I don't know if you wanna set these up even to put them on the side where people can, so they don't have to come all the way up front to access these. But you tech folks can, or if you can come up and ask a question, or you can stand up and raise your hand and shout out loud and we'll repeat the question, however you want to do this. Or you might have roving microphone people. Is that what you have? Okay, all right. What questions do you have?
Okay, I got a question. If it's abstract, I don't know if I'm saying this correctly, but I'll say it. How well do we pay attention to what's stored in our subconscious mind?
Your question is?
How well do we pay attention to what's stored in our subconscious mind?
So the question is, how well do we pay attention to what's stored in our subconscious? Or in our world, we might say, we talk about non-conscious mind, the things that we're not aware of, right? Which is tricky. Because by definition, if I'm not conscious of something, it's hard for me to pay attention to much, right? By definition, right? But here's the thing, and this is where this is why storytelling, which we're going to talk about this afternoon, storytelling is such a big deal. We're going to learn that we don't ever tell our stories by ourselves. We are always telling our stories collaboratively. Most of what troubles us about our non-conscious mind, we have access to because someone else begins to ask us questions about who we are. All right? So it can be then, if I begin to practice, if someone starts to ask me questions. So for instance, the gentleman that I talked about earlier, the really effective guy, but who had two really lovely, caring parents, but one of whom was brutal. Okay? That was non-conscious for him until we start to ask questions. And now it's no longer non-conscious. Now it's conscious to him. But it's not just that that fact becomes conscious. But the notion of even being curious about how that happened now becomes conscious, right? It's not just that we want to be people who learn more things about our lives. We want to learn how to be more curious about our lives, right? This notion of Jesus asking John's disciples, what are you looking for? Can you imagine? Can you imagine Jesus, if Jesus were to ask us this question? There might be a lot that I didn't imagine that God would ask me that kind of a question. I'm sure that there's a lot stored in my non-conscious mind that I'll get back to you on that. But that's the point. We absolutely need the help of other people in helping us bring that to bear, right? And that.
But does that, even not knowing, does it ultimately control us unconsciously?
Well, and I think it's probably, does it ultimately control us? I think it's probably fair to say that, and we'll get to this again when we talk about shame's role, our non-conscious mind regulates a lot of who we are, but it doesn't regulate everything about who we are. It regulates some, but not everything. I mean, like, your non-conscious mind did not get you into the car. Like, you decided to get in the car to drive here today. We decided to have certain conversations or not have certain conversations. Our non-conscious mind is not running that show. Our non-conscious mind might be running a lot of things, but the real question that comes up for like, oh gosh, what am I not aware of? The real question that comes up to help us answer that would be, well gosh, what are those moments when my life looks less integrated, right? There's a lot that my non-conscious mind does that's actually quite fine. It helps me drive the car and still have a conversation. But what if, in the course of the conversation, I get irritated? What if I'm the guy who has the fight with my wife and leaves, and all I think that's going on here is that I'm having the fight with my wife? I don't recognize that my dad is standing behind her. Those kinds of questions start that person down the path to become more curious about other parts of their life. We're going to talk about, like, what does it mean for us to write our autobiography? And how does that play a role in actually helping to bring parts of our non-conscious to the surface?
I have a question. I wanted to know your perspective on whether or not you've ever seen a connection between shame and bipolar.
Have I ever seen a connection between shame and bipolar? So let me just say, in a connection in what sense?
Well, could maybe some trauma early in life develop shame in an individual and that later manifests itself in bipolar disorder?
Right, so everybody hear that question? Okay, and you know, this is a question that I think references lots of things that we think about in life. So for instance, many of you may be familiar with bipolar disorder. You might know someone who has it. You might be a person who's struggled with that. And part of the challenge in the world of mental health is the fact that, with some rare exceptions, we don't really have clear-cut conditions that we can identify scientifically. So for instance, bipolar disorder is one of those examples of people who demonstrate real impairment, real challenges with their mood regulation. No question about that. But we don't have some single technology or some single test that we can give to someone who says, oh yes, you have bipolar disorder, in the same way that we can test someone for sickle cell anemia. We don't have that. That doesn't mean that they don't have a condition that is deeply marked by those kinds of mood instabilities. It simply means that they have a condition, the nature of which, if we're going to try to regulate that and help them regulate that, will probably, most likely, include some kind of medical intervention, some kind of psychopharmacology. That's true for lots of different psychiatric conditions. When someone says, I have depression, for instance, we inform them, there is no such thing as depression per se. It's not like there's you and me and depression that are in the room, right? Depression's not in the room with us. Are you depressed? Absolutely. Do you experience these symptoms? Absolutely. Depression is a word that we use to describe a collection of symptoms that a person has that we try to address in multiple different ways, often which requires medical intervention, requires use of antidepressants and even with ECT and other forms of that. The question of shame, however, the question of shame is, it's everywhere. It's in everything. So is there a connection between shame and bipolar? Yes. Between shame and depression? Yes. Between shame and schizophrenia? Yes. Between shame and breathing? Yes. Right, there's going to be a connection. But it's also the case that because of what shame does, in our neuropsychiatric lexicon, the way we kind of categorize things, it's also entirely possible that a person who, let's say, at age 17, I'll say this because I have had this experience with patients, at age 17 has an experience in which they are given the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And by the time they're 35, we recognize that what looked like affect dysregulation was really about 8 years of chronic incessant sexual abuse. And this person's inability to regulate their affect had as much to do with trauma as it had to do with some independent form of a psychiatric condition that looks an awful lot like the thing that we call bipolar disorder. And shame certainly plays a role in all that. Not least of which, the role of how it is that we go about even thinking about how to diagnose these things, how we even reflect on this, if that makes sense. Yep. Yep.
Hello, doctor. In thinking through what we've covered so far, and I know there's a lot to come, I feel myself having conflicted views already about being known and which requires another person, someone else to interact with, mm-hmm. and wanting to guard myself from that very same person.
Of course.
Things coming to mind like when Jean-Paul Sartre says hell is other people because they present a risk to us in being known, especially.
Right.
Or causing us to view ourselves in a certain way. How is there a way to find balance between being known and those deep feelings of other people are dangerous,
right?
Especially as I'm being known.
Right. It's a great question, and my guess is like it's a million-dollar question, right? My guess is like you may be the only person in the room who's wondering this, right? Right, I mean, like, I think you're articulating a question that everybody's probably wondering, right? We all desire, I mean, ideally, if we could guarantee being known and nobody gets hurt, who wouldn't do this, right? But therein lies the problem, right? We can even imagine, like, you're imagining Genesis 1, 26 and 27. We're imagining the Holy Trinity having a conversation about this, right? We're going to, you know, you're thinking like, hey, let us make mankind in our image. And there's Jesus thinking, I'm not sure this is such a good idea, right? Because there is that whole Good Friday thing. Did y'all think about that, right? You too, right? Father, Spirit, did you consider that, right? Right, so here's the thing. I want to suggest that the question that you're raising is something to which Jesus would say, I get it. This is really hard to do. But the very thing that we did in making you, making us, we knew we were taking a risk. We know this. But we will also say that our choice, we like to say, look, you've got two options in life. You can work really hard and stay in prison, or you can work really hard and go free. But hard work is not an option. And so the question is going to be, who are going to be the people that are going to allow me to be known deeply, deeply enough, whereby which this becomes something that I'm willing to practice? And I want to suggest to us here, even now, that this process of being known, this process of putting shame to death in this way, I want to tell you, I'm fully convinced, is going to be one of the primary ways forward to creating outposts of goodness and beauty that are going to be primary things that we use for evangelism in the next 50 years. Right, because I'll tell you, like, the common way, the common motifs and metaphors that we think about Christianity in the West, particularly in the United States, like, they are being swept away. And until and or unless we know that we are going to have flourishing communities of people who are willing to be deeply known, the attraction of which will be irresistible to others around them. Because who doesn't really want this? Yes, it's going to be hard. There is no other way to life. Thanks. Thanks for asking.
Oh, I have a question. Piggybacking off of the talking about being known and this idea of intimacy, my wife and I have talked a lot about how in the church, in general, there's this picture. We understand that. We know that. We see that. But the best picture that we come up with is marriage. And though that's good, it also ends up kind of leading to this place where we kind of see singles or divorced or whatever as kind of secondary citizens, you know, like, oh, you'll be fully human when you get married. You know, you just sit down, hold on for a little while.
Right.
How do we create an image, a memory, a story, a collective story that is bigger than that, that includes the idea of being known, of intimacy, that obviously includes marriage, but it kind of goes beyond that.
What's your name?
Ben.
Ben, we have more to talk about, right, later. Okay, so you're also putting your finger on a really important topic. I want to suggest, what happens in Dallas stays in Dallas?
We're in Frisco.
Oh, that's right, we're in Frisco, so those rules don't apply? I should be speaking somewhere else. Okay, it's a great question, and it opens us into a larger conversation. And I'm just going to offer some reflections. And these are not, I'm not a theologian. I'm not a biblical scholar. Those are two things I like to say, so I can get myself out of jail free if I get into trouble. Okay. Yeah, they trained me well in psycho school. So here's one thing I would suggest. One thing is that marriage is a particular motif in the biblical narrative. But the Bible itself nowhere says that marriage is the most important way of understanding communion or community with God. Paul writes about how we should be in marriage. Paul writes about how marriage is a particular way of picturing Christ in the church, right? Paul nowhere says this is the only way for us to think about it. Moreover, what do we do with Luke chapter 20? When the Sadducees come to Jesus and give him the song and dance about the woman who's married to seven brothers, whose will she be? Notice, she's property, right? This is great, right? Whose will she be in the age to come? And Jesus says, like, y'all don't get it. There will be no giving or taking of marriage in the age to come. What does that say to we who think that marriage is the holy grail of relationships? Right, we live in a culture in which the church is drinking the culture's Kool-Aid, wherein which, first of all, if we're not married, we're second-class citizens. Because the holy grail of life is to find that other who will fulfill my life, right? We're all about marriage as long as the marriage can do for me what I want it to do. Does that make sense? And if I'm single, like I'm in trouble because I don't have the thing that will do for me what I want it to. And if I'm in a marriage that is not doing for me what I want it to, then I'm in the wrong marriage. Which means I leave and go find a different marriage. No, marriage is about death. That wasn't even supposed to be funny. Dang, I'm so glad my wife is not coming till this afternoon. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for like, what's confusing about this? It's not confusing. It's hard. It doesn't say anything about like getting for me what I want to get out of this. There is, and I'm going on, all that to say is that I think that there are models. I would, if you have not read it, I would suggest highly Wesley Hill's book, Spiritual Friendship. Highly recommend this because think about this for a second. Okay, so this we're gonna stop. I'm gonna finish with this. See what you've done, Ben? Okay, no shame, right? But stay with me here for a second. Imagine this for a second, right? Okay, so if when we get married, when people get married, you know, you are committed for life, which is a good thing. There are all kinds of good, right things about this. But how many of us here are married? Who would? Okay, let me finish my sentence. I know you're eager to go to lunch, right? How many of us who are married who would say, gosh, you know, if I knew then everything I know now about marriage, how many of us would say, like, I'm not sure I would get married? Oh, you're afraid to raise your hands, aren't you? Right, look. Nobody's saying we wouldn't get married. Well, I mean, we're just acknowledging like that's really hard to do, right? But we stay together for a lot of reasons. We stay together because we've made a commitment. We stay together because we are bound within the church. We stay together because we're, but we need help to stay together, right? Lots of effort. But friendship, you know, if I get a new job in D.C., I'm going to take my job and go. I got close friends here, but like, I wouldn't leave my wife here. I can take my wife with me to my new job, but my friends, I leave my friends. I might have deeply committed friendship relationships to which I am not really willing to pay that kind of price, that I know that I have to pay in marriage because I'm bound to it. Then why is it that Jesus says in John, no greater love has this, that a man lays down his life for his friends, not for his spouse, not for his child, for his friends. Because I will tell you this, part of why that's important is because friends can leave. And when friends lay down their lives for friends is because they choose not to leave when they can. And that, my friend, is what it means to be known. And that's hard to do. I think you have a book waiting to be written.